This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy.
The Daily Beast reports that two of the Republican candidates for president, Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry, are, quote, deeply associated with a theocratic strain of Christian fundamentalism that's called dominionism.
All right, now the mainstream media's hostility towards Christianity is no secret.
In recent weeks, there's been a flurry of news stories referencing Christianist authoritarianism, dominionism, and other terms connected to the concept of an evangelical theocracy. I actually thought someone had visited my hometown. This is not an area the media tends to delve into, and much of the impetus has been the nakedly religious language used by several leading Republican presidential aspirants. Perhaps predictably, the more mainstream of these stories have leaned toward denying that a longstanding movement of this nature exists. But is this just liberal paranoia at best, or is it Christian bashing at worst? We'll climb the seven mountains with Religion Dispatch's senior editor Sarah Posner on this week's show.
This is not a redemption story. Born again? Christ, no. We're still waiting to be born. Not waiting, hoping.
That's best-selling author and journalist Jeff Charlotte. We'll be talking about his brand new book, Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. But first, happy Labor Day, everybody.
Thousands of state workers are objecting to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's call for an immediate 8% cut in their benefits.
Explain what Governor Kasich has introduced.
We have a budget deficit looming, and they're using that crisis as an excuse to go after the rights of public employees.
Considering the setbacks for organized labor and working Americans in a number of states this year, most notably Wisconsin and Ohio, it's ironic that most of us will be enjoying this long holiday weekend with very little thought given to the origin of the holiday that gives it its name, Labor Day. How has the movement gone from being a driving force for workers' rights, rights that at one time seemed quite literally were matters of life and death, to being just another political football and electoral wedge issue? Well, here to observe Labor Day in a way that has nothing to do with picnics and barbecues is Ted Smuckler, Public Policy Director at Interfaith Worker Justice, a national nonprofit organization that works to encourage that religious values be reflected in efforts to improve rights and conditions for workers, especially low-wage workers. Ted, I'm glad you're here. Welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much, Walton.
Have good friends in your fellowship over there and respect what you do.
Great.
IWJ was deeply involved in the struggle to defend public employee rights in Wisconsin. And you've had a very busy year elsewhere, and I want to talk about that, but I'd like for us to start with you talking just a little bit about the origins of Labor Day first, and then the importance of workers organizing, because I think a lot of people today think that sounds almost anachronistic.
Yes, Labor Day started, I believe, in the 1910s. It was first designated a national holiday to celebrate the work of labor unions in our society. You know, it was not to celebrate the end of the summer or a chance to see friends and family. It was to celebrate the role of unions. And Interfaith Worker Justice has, for the past 15 years, has had a program for services on the weekend before Labor Day called Labor in the Pulpit. It's also on the Bima for synagogues and in the Minbar for mosques. And it's a chance for congregations to listen to and think about what's happening to working people today.
You know, Ted, I am amazed at the number of people who no longer understand the relationship between organized labor and religious progressive movements in this nation. That's where the organized labor movement came from. How have we become so insensitive and unknowledgeable about that?
Well, I think there are people who wanted us to become insensitive. But, you know, a lot of happened. You know, there are two particular religious denominations that have always been very strong in supporting the rights of labor and others that support workers in general, almost every major faith. But the Catholics and the Jews in this country from the early 20th century onward were very, very strong supporters of the rights of workers to organize. They developed labor schools to teach workers their rights, the Catholic labor schools and also the Jewish Lyceum. And, you know, a part of that was that these communities were working class immigrant communities. Right now, many Catholics and Jews have achieved a modicum of success in this society and have dispersed from urban areas. And so the remembrance of that isn't as strong.
What have been the areas of focus for Interfaith Worker Justice this past year?
So we've had three primary areas of focus. We have been involved for years in campaigns to address wage theft, which is the practice of unethical employers stealing workers' wages, either by not paying minimum wage, not paying overtime, not giving last paychecks, or as we're finding more and more, what we call payroll fraud, where workers who are really employees are classified as independent contractors. Our second major campaign, we're calling Keeping the Faith with America's Workers. And it grew out of these, you know, these really extreme attacks on worker rights, both public sector and private sector workers, in Wisconsin, Ohio, but also other places, Michigan, Indiana, Maine, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Florida. So there's been, you know, a sort of concerted effort to basically end collective bargaining rights for public workers and to make it really difficult to organize unions. For private sector workers, the right to work bills, which is a misnomer, the right to work for less, really, which are going to be moving in Indiana and Michigan. You know, that we already have 24 states that are right to work states, and the standard of living is well below those who are not right to work states. So we've been doing religious outreach, and we have some great material about this campaign on our website, which is www.iwj.org, and a number of materials on keeping faith with America's workers for Labor Day. And our third major campaign is around unemployment, and we've organized a coalition effort of more than 40 denominational and faith organizational leaders, both at the national and the state level, called Faith Advocates for Jobs.
Ted Smuckler is the Public Policy Director at Interfaith Worker Justice. You can find out more about the work of this organization. Go to iwj.org. Ted, happy Labor Day, and thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Walt.
We've got to take a break, but please stay tuned. Best-selling author and journalist Jeff Charlotte will be here to talk about his new book, Sweet Heaven When I Die. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Author, journalist, and professor Jeff Charlotte has spent a great deal of time among people who think they're better than the rest of us because God made them so, and feel they are entitled to direct this entire nation towards a vision of America that would be both anathema to the founders and is enormously lucrative for themselves. Jeff has chronicled what he learned in two best-selling books, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power, and C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. Both of those books are now available in paperback. Nobody else is telling these stories from the level of familiarity and depth of research as he is, and by his resilience. His writing voice is never jaded and never hopeless. And now we know one of the reasons why. In an email he sent out announcing the release on August 15th of his new book of essays, Sweet Heaven When I Die. I love saying that. Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. Jeff described this project with the following words, and I'm quoting, "These are the stories I wrote to keep myself sane during my long immersion in American fundamentalism for my last two books." Jeff Charlotte, congratulations on this terrific new book, and welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's wonderful to be with you again.
In reading Sweet Heaven When I Die, I thought more than once, what a big heart you have. There is a love for and an empathy with the 13 characters that you write about that just radiates from every page. How would you say these stories fit together in your mind?
Well, as I decided I wanted to gather these stories, that as you said, the stories that I wrote to keep myself sane, that was my first criteria. What were the pieces that really kept me mentally healthy while I was working on those last two books about fundamentalism? But I realized that I was drawn again and again to people who, very much in an American grain in a sense, self-made or self-invented, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, but people who walk a kind of tightrope between despair and desire.
I know how hard it is to write. It is a very laborious task. But as I imaged you writing this book, I saw happiness. I saw eagerness in writing. Is that close to true?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Although I have to confess that I feel that same kind of joy when I was writing my last two books, when I'm writing about fundamentalism. To me, you know, because I write so much about religion, I often get asked, well, you know, what's your faith position and what's your tradition and so on?
Yeah.
And I said, well, didn't you notice? I write books. This is it. This is it. This is my this is my religion. This is my joy. This is my sweet heaven, and I don't have to wait until I die.
Well, listen, talk a little bit, if you will, about the people that you write about in Sweet Heaven When I Die.
Yeah, well, I start the book. It's a mix of everyday people and better known people. There's Cornel West, who I spent about a year going down to Princeton and interviewing him over the course of a year. And of course, he's a very well documented individual. But I was interested in that mix of theology and philosophy and blues and jazz that shapes his vision and that goes beyond whatever political controversy of the day. And he's in the midst of one right now, but goes deep into this understanding of the prophetic tradition that I think really that becomes sort of the anchor of the book in some ways, of looking at other people, this idea that the prophetic tradition allows us to describe the world as it is, not to speak of what is to come, but to describe the world around us and to engage also with concrete evils and to do that. And so each of the characters, for instance, Brad Will is an amazing individual, died in 2006. He was a part of the American anarchist scene, a pretty effective organizer in his day, but in his late 30s decided to become a journalist, and it was really becoming one, and went down to Oaxaca, Mexico, where the teacher strike had turned into a general uprising against that country's very corrupt and repressive regime. Brad was down there. He was a video journalist, and in 2006, as he was covering the sort of the battle between the government's police and military forces and the people, he was shot, and he actually filmed his own murder. If you slow down the video close enough, you see the puff of smoke. I mean, I suppose if you could slow it down that slow, you would see the bullet moving inch by inch toward him, and then bam, and Brad falls down. But he's become since a sort of a martyr for that anarchist movement, a role he certainly would not have liked. He didn't want to be a martyr. He wanted to live and tell stories, and again I encounter that. I write about Hava Rosenfarb, the last great Yiddish writer, bore witness to the Łódź ghetto in Poland, and the most magnificent book about the Holocaust that I know, and very little known because it's in Yiddish, but there is an English translation called The Tree of Life. And each of these people, to me, there's no easy hope in a guy who films his own murder or a woman who is writing about the Holocaust, or Cornel West, who speaks of all his hope coming from the death shudders, as he puts it, that he experiences. Mm-hmm. But that, to me, is a very kind of honest hope, and one that points to something beyond the kind of sort of cheering and rah-rah political culture that we mm-hmm. sometimes live in.
Where does faith or faithlessness come into play in these characters?
Well, first I'd answer yes. You got it right. the reader's interpretation, all errors interpretation are mine alone. The reader's understanding of the book, I have a fairly democratic feeling about that, is mm-hmm. always correct in its way. But, I use that subtitle, Faith and Faithlessness in the Country in Between. And obviously, this is a book mostly about the country in between. And some of these folks, like Cornel West, it's fairly obvious. He's a guy who's, among other things, a theologian. Or mm-hmm. there are three essays about fundamentalism in here. Or a long piece, I can't say the name on radio, Sweet F-All Colorado, named after a bar there, and about a trip. And my long love affair with Colorado, my sort of mountain religion of my youth, and a trip back to see an old friend who had once been with me on the left and had become a rising star in the Republican Party and had become very religious. But we found a lot of common ground nonetheless because she's a person of great political imagination. Maybe the answer is a little bit in a piece called The Rapture, and it's about a New Age a priestess, I guess. She is, in fact, a priestess of the High Council of Gore, she declares herself. Sandra Shea does all sorts of magical things, says she's part fairy. And if you're out there saying, well, this person just sounds like a fringe and a nut, you should understand that she was once a very high-powered lawyer, and she still makes a very good living doing spiritual cleansings of high-end real estate in New York for some of the most elite firms that very quietly make use of these sort of magical things. Now, I'm not vouching for this. That's up to you to decide to do it. But I spent some time with her. I spent a time at a workshop. Cost a couple $1,000s. I got comped. I was lucky. In which I was knighted in the Brotherhood Sisterhood of White Light, and I was knighted by none other than Jesus, which was confusing. Sandra's Jewish, but then so was Jesus, and she's channeling Jesus. And Jesus tells me who I am as a writer. And so what Jesus tells me is that I'm not a seeker, she or he said. I'm a doubter. Doubt, she said, is a calling. It is not unbelief. It is in between. That's my niche. So this is Jesus speaking to me. Sandra, Jesus whispered, my place in the chain of supply and demand. Doubt, Jesus said, is your revelation.
We got to take a quick break, but we're going to come right back. My guest is best-selling author Jeff Charlotte. Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance.
Bring back when I want to, whiskey
This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. I couldn't wait to get back. I'm talking to best-selling author Jeff Charlotte, whose new book of essays, Sweet Heaven, When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between, has just been released on August 15th. Jeff, I want to ask you, if you will, to read a brief passage from your book. Tell us what you're going to read and then have at it.
Well, I'll read from the final essay. It's called Born, comma, Again. That comma makes all the difference. And it's about it's about two things. It's about the 1920s banjo player Doc Boggs, probably never heard of him, recorded eight songs that are, you know, it's like people talk about the Velvet Underground. Not many people bought their records, but everyone who did started a band. Doc Boggs is hugely influential in American music. And so I wrote about him juxtaposed with some personal stories about some friends who had just lost a child and my own disappointments and so on. And Doc Boggs is this deep, dark, mean, nasty country blues from the 1920s. He was a bad man. I mean, not, he was a truly bad man, but I was struggling toward that empathy with him. So Boggs wasn't quite a human being yet, not a whole one, but then who is? We are none of us human yet, only trying and quitting and trying and tiptoeing out the back door. We recorded our eight sides and went home singing the down south blues, and then we had a baby, and now the little guy, the little gal, is going up north, always up north, where they're going to sing their little hearts out, to escape the mines, to get up from underground, to walk like a man, walk like a woman, to become human. We are trying to become human, and we are not there yet. We are still licking our wounds, fighting over cesspools, sitting perplexed by the side of the water, or brokenhearted in the middle of the pond while the world blows up and sparkles. We're praying that the baby will live, knowing it might now, recognizing that there are odds, there are always odds, a chance, a gamble, a blues, which is why there will always be another Boggs revival, or if not of Boggs, then of some singer like him, a man or a woman who wanted to be human and failed and accepted that and then tried again anyway. This is not a redemption story. Born again? Christ, no. We're still waiting to be born, not waiting, hoping.
Gosh. Jeff, I get a sense from this book that you allow for the possibility that these characters that you write about aren't really that unusual, that they may wear their eccentricities on their sleeve, but that in fact they fit into the tapestry of our diverse society pretty seamlessly. This isn't a freak show, am I right?
Absolutely not. And I think that's been, I mean, that's been what's shaped my writing about religion for a long time. And although I know a lot of readers in my books, like The Family, say, oh, those people are the fringe. Part of the argument I've always been trying to make is, you know what, there isn't really a fringe. There is no fringe. And that's one of the, that is the strength and complexity of especially belief and unbelief. An American life. The margins of faith are where we need to go to understand the center. And if you think that you're that different from Sandra Shea, this New Age priestess, or from Doc Boggs, this mean old nasty banjo player, then think again.
Jeff, what about Hava Rosenfarb,
Yeah, Haven Rosenfarb unfortunately died just as this book was going to press. And she was, and probably will remain, I guess, the last great Yiddish writer. Yiddish, this language of Eastern European Jews, a language not quite extinguished by the Holocaust because the Hasidim, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, still speak Yiddish. But to them, it's not a literary language. They don't care. They're contemptuous of it. It had a great literature. And Haven Rosenfarb was this young woman in the Woloj ghetto, and she, what she did was she documented everything. She wrote this massive three-volume novel, Tree of Life, but I assure you it reads fast, even though it's three volumes, because it's a world. It's a world that is both being compressed and crumbling as the Nazis crush in. And Hava, unlike so many other people, was fascinated by everybody, the, you know, the heroes and the collaborators, the Nazis, the crooks. In some ways, it's the literary equivalent of the great – there's a great Ringelblum archive. It was a social scientist and I believe in the Warsaw ghetto. And as the Nazis crushed in, he said to everybody, he says, okay, everybody, you have to write down what your life was and not just the noble things. We're going to make a time capsule, but not just the best of us. You know, you were a doctor, tell us about that. You were a pimp, tell us about that. Everything. And we're going to bury it in these milk canisters under the street. And maybe some future civilization, because we're all about to die, will discover this. And some of that has been discovered, and I think some of it still hasn't. And Hava Rosenfarb's novel is, in some ways, the literary equivalent of that.
What did writing this book do to your own personal faith?
Well, if I dodge that question again and say my own personal faith is writing, I can say it served it well. You know, hope is a word that is so badly abused. You know, hope is not something that we have when we think we have a chance. We don't hope that our candidate might win because our candidate might win. We don't hope that we might do well on the test because if we've tried to prepare, then we might. Hope is something that comes out of despair. Hope mm-hmm. is something when you don't have any odds. And so many of the people, you know, Haven Rosenfarb and the Woloj ghetto, Cornel West and his real existential dread, Brad Will facing down his own murderer, Doc Boggs turning his back on fame and fortune and so on. These were places of despair, and I think in writing these I sort of came to understand that as a place that I'm comfortable with because I do think that that's where hope comes from, and it's also where political imagination comes from. I spent a lot of time, as we've talked about, documenting some big political problems we mm-hmm. have in the mm-hmm. United States, and I'm generally not, you know, many on the progressives and the left and so on, you know, say, well, let's rally around this Democrat or this independent or that independent. And that just seems, sure, maybe that's what you got to do, but that's a stunted imagination. And I couldn't live with that, man. When I was in the midst of writing these books about just how powerful the right was, that wasn't going to sustain me. So the faith, if you want to call it spiritual in the sense of thinking about hope and despair, mm-hmm. And also maybe a kind of a whole pantheon of little American gods, not just one god, but all kinds of gods. I like this. You can go to a different town and you encounter a different god. Many of them may have the name Jesus, and some of them may be cruel, and some of them may be wonderful. So all these things kind of came together to that is, you know, you said, what does it do to my faith? And in addition to keeping me sane, that's it, keeping me sane, but also moving on and out of that world of fundamentalism and toward the next books and keeping my imagination alive.
Jeff Charlotte's an award-winning journalist, the best-selling author, most recently of The Family in C Street, and most definitely someone in whose company you will enjoy meeting the 13 characters presented in his new book, Sweet Heaven When I Die. Jeff teaches creative nonfiction at Dartmouth College, and he joined us today from their campus studios. Jeff, I thank you for being with us, and I do wish you great success with this book. And I would say, I suppose, as Cornel West would say, but I can't say it as eloquently, right on, brother.
Thanks very much, Willem.
We have to take a quick break, but stay tuned. Religion Dispatches senior editor Sarah Posner will be here to finally make sense of dominionism for us. Well, maybe I shouldn't go that far. But we will try to get a better understanding of this controversial philosophy with someone who has invested a lot of time in covering it. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief Radio. Don't go away. We're coming right back. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. A concept that has recently bubbled to the surface in mainstream media coverage of religion and politics, dominionism, has led to charges of liberal paranoia and even anti-Christian propaganda. This is not an easy subject to address within the confines of a radio broadcast, but it's important that we address it, and as we do, I want to point you to some excellent coverage of the topic at Religion Dispatches. Past State of Belief Radio guest Julie Ingersoll has a terrific article up, as does Peter Montgomery. There's also an in-depth analysis of Anthea Butler, who's appeared on this program, written in tandem with Religion Dispatches senior editor Sarah Posner. And I know you know Sarah. Sarah's a frequent and always welcome guest here, and I'm happy to have her join us once again. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It is nice to be back.
One recent attempt at coming up with a definitive evaluation of the significance of dominionism appeared in the Washington Post, where former Wall Street Journal writer and post-religion columnist Lisa Miller seemed to dismiss those fearful of an authoritarian evangelical plan for influencing and even dominating government as ignorant paranoia. Is Lisa Miller right when she writes, quote, "Some on the left seem suspicious that a firm belief in Jesus equals a desire to take over the world. Evangelicals generally do not want to take over the world. Dominionism, in its broadest sense, describes a Christian's obligation to be active in the world, including in politics and government." That's Lisa Miller. This is Sarah Posner.
Well, what she describes with the Christian obligation to get involved in politics and government has been described by some evangelicals themselves as their dominion mandate, which they take out of the book of Genesis. Now, of course, we don't have time for a theological debate about whether they're right about what the dominion mandate really means. But the way that many in the political religious right have interpreted that is to say we have an obligation as Christians to get involved in government, in law, in politics, in media. So this explains the rise of the Christian Coalition, a desire to get Christians more involved in government, a particular kind of evangelical Christian more involved in government, to train them to run for school board, to run for city council, to run for higher office. This is exactly why we now have a candidate like Michelle Bachmann. Now, we can debate, is Michelle Bachmann a dominionist? That debate doesn't really matter. I think what matters for our politics is that we debate what Michelle Bachmann's political career and political positions have said about what she thinks about government and politics and religion. But the reality is she went to a law school whose founder has said, it was a Christian law school at Oral Roberts University, later got absorbed at Regent University, which was founded by Pat Robertson. The founder of the law school, Herb Titus, described his thought process in wanting to found a Christian law school to counter secularism in the law. He described that as his dominion mandate. He was acting out his dominion mandate. So it's not a secret conspiracy by the evangelical right to, quote-unquote, take over the world. It's been a very public, you know, out-in-the-open effort to create almost a parallel universe, or alternatively, you know, a universe in which the Christians dominate in government or in the law, and their position dominates in the law. So they get case law on the separation of church and state overturned. So It's not a secret conspiracy. They've been very upfront about this. And so if you followed the conservative movement, you know, for the last four decades, they've been very public about this is what they want. So to deny that dominionism exists is putting your head in the sand. But, I mean, so that Lisa Miller's piece was very surprising to me because she's covered religion for a long time, and all of this stuff has been very, very public and described by many evangelicals themselves as dominionism or acting out their dominion mandate.
I grew up listening to dominionist theology.
Yes, I'm sure you did.
Absolutely. Now, they did. We didn't know to call it that.
Yes.
It was more about an approach to the Bible than it was an approach about government, but in the epistles of the New Testament, you have the Apostle Paul writing, every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And in the book of Revelation, one of the few things in there I understand, there is a very clear verse. It's one of the most political verses in all of the scriptures. That says the kingdoms of this world shall become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I interpret that differently, but knowing that you have someone who went to a very conservative school and learned a almost literalist interpretation of Scripture, it's hard for me to believe they don't know what they're talking about.
Right, exactly.
And they're talking about takeover.
Right. And you could make the argument that they are using democratic processes to do this. They're training candidates to run for office. So, and they're doing that quite openly.
And rewriting history so that there's no separation of religion and government.
Exactly. So rewriting history a la David Barton of Wall Builders, training lawyers at these law schools like the one that Michelle Bachmann went to reinterpret constitutional law in such a way so that they can go out and argue cases to ultimately overturn case law on the separation of church and state. Now, there's a Christian law firm called the Alliance Defense Fund. It was founded by many of the luminaries of the religious right. Its stated purpose was to be a Christian counterweight to the ACLU,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they didn't like, among other things, the ACLU's advocacy for the separation of church and state. When I did an article about the Alliance Defense Fund, one of its lawyers was very upfront with me that their goal was to get the Lemon case overturned, which is the seminal Supreme Court case which lays out the test for whether a government action violates the separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
Their very public stated purpose is dismantling the Supreme Court jurisprudence on the separation of church and state. That's a dominionist idea. It's drawn from, you know, that kind of theology. They don't run around saying that they're dominionists, but so it's not, you know, like, it's not like it's a secret conspiracy, and at the same time, they've been very public about what they want to do.
So what scares you most about this?
This idea of the biblical worldview being supreme,
mm-hmm.
being on a collision course with these other so-called worldviews that are in conflict with and that you must, as a Christian, it's your duty to overcome. So I think it's been very damaging to our political discourse because they have framed, say, the health care reform bill, the Patient Protection Act, as a socialist endeavor. And socialism, communism, Marxism is one of the quote-unquote worldviews that they feel like they need to combat. Or when you look at these current attacks on efforts by Muslims to build mosques, Islam is one of the other worldviews that they claim that they are, that the biblical worldview is in conflict with.
Right.
So once they start framing political adversaries as socialist, communist, Marxists, and position themselves as being the, as Michelle Bachmann likes to say, using a sort of military evangelical term, she has been the tip of the spear in fighting what she calls Obamacare. Well, that very much comes out of the idea that she's engaged in some sort of cosmic spiritual war.
There are excellent resources at Religion Dispatches with extensive recent coverage of dominionism. Make sure you read the material posted by Sarah Posner as well as some of the other writers at religiondispatches.org, where Sarah is senior editor. She's also the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah, time flies when you're on this show, because you know some stuff, and it's good to talk about. Thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Boy, time has flown by. Visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, listen to show archives, and sign up for our podcast. Tell us what you like about the program, and also tell us what you think we could do a lot better on the program. We really do want to hear from you. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including our listener line, 202-238-3291. Make that phone ring sometime, though. We just need to know that it still works. 202-238-3291. And tell a friend about our show. Encourage others to listen with you. Get your friends together and listen. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. You can find out more information on the work of the Alliance, both in Washington and in chapters across the country, at interfaithalliance.org. This work is important. Looks like it's becoming more important every day, as a matter of fact. And it deserves your support. Deserves your support, and we need your support. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week. We'll observe the 10th anniversary of 9/11 with reflections and messages from several prominent faith leaders. And we'll have more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.